Hi everyone, this is the podcast for the Orfila Center's Structural Violence, Police and Prison Abolition and Decoloniality Research Cluster. In this series, we feature the compelling works of different scholars and activists whose research touches upon violence, marginalization, and carcerality. Today, we will be talking to Dr. Felice Blake. Dr. Felice Blake is an associate professor in the English department at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She has published work on racism, culture, and resistance in Al Jazeera Ethnic and Racial Studies, African American Review, and Souls, a critical journal of Black politics, culture, and society. Dr. Blake is the author of Black Love, Black Hate, Intimate Antagonisms in African American Literature, and co-editor of Anti-Racism, Inc., Why the Way We Talk About Racial Justice Matters. Thank you so much, Dr. Blake, for agreeing to do this podcast. So throughout your career, you have written extensively about the themes of structural oppression, global white supremacy and racism, problematic discourses of colorblindness in the humanities, Black cultural production, immigration and racist policies in Europe, and more. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research trajectory and about yourself? I know that you spent a lot of time in Norway and you did research there. So how has it been for you to write about these themes from different locations like the US and Norway? And what led you to study these different themes?
Yeah, so first, thank you so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure to get to know you from our own research involvement. So it's wonderful to have a chance, first of all, to talk with you, to talk about these important concepts and to share a little bit about my own work. So I am actually from Santa Barbara County. People who know me through UCSB have heard me say this before, but I actually was born and raised in Lompoc, California. My parents are from the Jim Crow South, so from North Carolina. My parents were teenage parents. The military was an option, as it is for a lot of young people, especially young people of color, you know, coming from difficult economic circumstances. And for them at that time, the military was an option for income as they were teenage parents with young children. And so that is what brought my father from the South and eventually to settle at Vandenberg Air Force Base, which is where I was born. I mentioned that in part because that family history, I think, speaks to some of the complexity that's informed my work. So yes, a Black family, but from California, not from Oakland or LA, but from this sort of Central Coast area. Their progress into home ownership happened because of another serviceman who was of Mexican descent, but here in the US, who was married to a white woman, who in that way was able to purchase a home in California in the late 60s. He was being stationed elsewhere and did this sort of private home sale with my father, which allowed my parents to come into home ownership. So again, a lot of these larger histories about discrimination, about immigration, about racism, militarization, were always present in my family. And yet we never talked about them in that way. And it's really been through my own educational experience that I too tried to figure out my own background, my own life story. And I think in trying to figure out who I am, right, where I come from, was a part of why I was an interested student and how it put me on the path to studying the things that I study now. So again, you know, when I was, you know, a young student in California, like so many others, you know, we didn't speak so much about the Chumash, right? This is Santa Barbara County, but we did have trips to the museum where we saw them, right, in sort of display cases as a kind of forgotten history and people who no longer existed. And yet I lived probably 2 miles from one of the reservations, right? La Purisima. So again, these were regular aspects and things that I saw every single day, the military base, the federal penitentiary in Lompoc, the reservation and the missions. And yet there was very little discussion as to what was producing the history of this tiny town of Lompoc in between, again, the sort of places where most attention was given, which was, you know, Los Angeles or the Bay Area. I say that in part to sort of make sense of the things that were a part of my own experience and that were leading me to ask questions and being open to learning different things when I became a student. So I studied abroad. I learned Spanish when I was an undergraduate because my thinking at the time was that I wanted to be a teacher. A high school teacher was really as far as I had thought. Like many people, you know, I had some positive experiences with teachers who encouraged me with regard to reading. And I was a very avid reader. I loved reading novels. I loved learning things as a student. In some ways, it was kind of escapism, which it can be for a lot of people. But in a world, in a context where things don't make a lot of sense, books were helping me to figure out my own life and emotions and different things. And so when I went to UCLA as an undergraduate, studying literature was this opportunity to really think about life and experience in ways that were helping me to piece together the conditions that were my own experience, my own background. So I wanted to teach. I learned Spanish because I imagined myself living in California. Again, like most people, we often end up where we were born. And so I thought, well, I'll be a teacher in California in some high school, and I should learn Spanish because that's really significant to the job. And I had a professor who said to me, have you ever thought about studying abroad? And that kind of was what brought me then out of the U.S. to Europe. I studied in Spain and then to Norway and so on. So it really, again, from my parents in the Jim Crow South to this life abroad, really was about making sense of all of that history and its complexities.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It prompts a lot of thought about how militarism and police violence really like affect our intimate lives. So in your writing, you talk about addressing the notion of colorblindness in the humanities and how the humanities as a field should engage in debates around structural oppression, and that it should like participate and give its insights to public discussion and action. So in line with that, can you tell us about what you see as the important connections between scholarship and activism, especially for those of us who are thinking about police violence and abolition? And does your teaching also come into consideration when thinking about the connections between scholarship and activism?
Yeah, this is such an important question. It's a big one. And I think it's so crucial, especially right now, that we keep asking it. I think that people of color, especially scholars of color, have always had to ask themselves about this. And the ultimate answers we're never going to arrive to, but it is absolutely a pressing question that we should be asking ourselves almost at every turn. Just kind of building on what I shared a little bit about my personal background, you know, part of what was happening for me, you know, these days we have language like local, global, acting locally, thinking globally. Well, this is often complicated, you know, when we sit in a place, it's like, you know, I'm from Lompoc. And so what are the local conditions and what are their connections to the global? So I gave some examples, right? The military, the FCI, a prison, settler colonialism, immigration, right? So we start to think, even from a small town like Lompoc, well, what are the conditions here and how are they related to a broader global context? And so I think that is an approach, if one can put it in those terms. You know, I've been thinking a lot about, especially again in this moment where we're seeing all kinds of horrors, you know, long-standing struggles for ethnic studies program and curricula in schools, a long-standing struggle with regard to book banning and censorship. Again, we know that these are the books and works by people of color that are most often on the list of books that are banned or censured. Of course, people are talking about critical race theory discourse and law and policies that are prohibiting even the teaching and discussion about anti-CRT, even as many of the people who are expressing right anxiety about critical race theory don't have a clear understanding about what it is. So in this moment in particular, it's so crucial to be thinking about what that scholarship means and what it means to what we'd like to imagine as activism. So I often go back to the example of the Freedom Schools. People aren't familiar with it. You can read about someone like Bob Moses, about Freedom Summers. Again, people, activists traveling often to the South, certainly doing that kind of work where they were from, but specific work in the South that was a part of sort of civil rights and ultimately Black power organizing, but thinking about the role of education. And I think that some of the fundamental questions that they ask, like, why are we in Freedom School, right? Like, why are we here studying in this way, is such a crucial question. As an educator now, we still have to ask ourselves, is the education that I'm offering allowing my students to make sense of their reality? What are the conditions that have produced the reality, right, that is informing their everyday lives? And also, from whose perspective are they learning how to understand and make sense of their reality and their everyday life? So again, that Freedom School model is really built on that. How do you help people, right? Help them. How do you elicit, right, and engage them in a conversation about their everyday lives? Why should one be in a Freedom School? What is it that we're after? What do we want, right? Is there a way that we can imagine a different world than the one that we currently live in right now? What do we have, right, that we want to keep and not, right, take from dominant culture? So those are the kind of questions I think that guide my thinking. I think that those are ways of challenging color blindness, which, you know, again, in 2022, I'm not sure that people would argue that colorblindness is necessarily the sort of guiding racial ideology. I think many of us are recognizing that explicit, right, the explicit espousal of racism, even though it's denied as racism, it's oftentimes being expressed as nationalism or patriotism, right? That these, again, become ways of challenging how we think about our current conditions and enable us to speak to these longer histories that have produced the conditions that really do inform our everyday. So that's been my approach. It's not always easy. It's difficult to underestimate the significance of repression that we're all experiencing right now, both in terms of what we teach, how we teach it, what we can say, people's livelihoods, their ability to work in meaningful ways and earn income to support themselves and their families, and also have dreams and visions for the future, imagining how to even just change the conditions in their local area. Again, the amount of repression, the degree to which we're so heavily policed cannot be understated. It really is significant and a factor that I think we all should be thinking about right now. So I should stop there. But those are some of the thoughts that keep me up at night right now.
Thank you. I think that's very powerful. And like, I think the professors that have affected me most are the ones that like prompt me to think about how all of these things feature in our daily lives. And I have a professor who used to say that teaching was her political work, and mm-hmm. I think your answer like resonates, like it reminds me of that. So thank you.
Yeah, it's a tough one because, you know, sometimes, you know, people will say, well, you know, I showed up and I taught Toni Morrison, or, well, I explained double consciousness, I included, you know, X author on a syllabus. And I don't think that that is enough, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's an important start, but we can't confuse the two. think a lot of people that I know who, for example, might go into jails, prisons, and other sites of confinement and torture, right, to engage with people, to provide educational programming, you know, these things are significant. I'm not downplaying it at all. But again, we also have to recognize, right, again, back to, why are we in freedom school, right? Mm-hmm. What are the conditions that have brought us here? And I promise you that if you enter into jails or prisons, and the book that you're offering, right, is Angela Davis, or it is, right, someone who's actively, you know, engaging students to understand how the prison industrial complex has come into existence, and helping people to understand the role of policing in their lives, that, you know, you will meet power saying that's not permitted. You're not allowed mm-hmm. to do that. You can't bring that in. So we want to be very clear, right, on teaching, which I think is important, but that is, it's okay for us to also recognize that the work of dismantling systems, right, is a different kind of work.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So for the next question, also speaking of teaching, I know that pedagogy is very important to you, and it's something you think about a lot. So can you share with us why that is, and what your experience has been with teaching students about racial justice, gendered racial capitalism, and abolition? You've written before about having students in your field saying, making statements like they don't do race. And at the same time, you're teaching a lot of students about these themes that, like you said, affect their daily lives and their struggles, and that they can then see around them.
Yeah. Again, these are really tough topics. I want to try to be as open and direct as I can for your podcast, because I think it's really important. You know, a former faculty person at UCSB has written a lot, and he used the phrase, you know, what does it mean to face up to what's killing us? And I think that is very difficult work to do. So, for example, you know, I am a Black woman. I am a faculty member here at UCSB. I'm one of very, very few Black faculty on the campus and Black women on the campus. I mentioned already that I'm from Santa Barbara County, but in my experience, K through 12, I can tell you that I had one Black teacher in elementary school. I had no Black teachers in middle school or high school. I had a Black coach from track, but K through 12, I admit, I had one Black teacher in the classroom. I was an undergraduate at UCLA, and there, you know, more Black instructors, but the number is under 5. So that's back in the 90s. So here we are in 2022, and for many of my students, I am the only Black faculty person that they will have interacted with in their experience of education. So when we use expressions like PWI, predominantly white institution, we really do have to understand what we're saying when we say that. And for my students to actually be confronted, right, with the fact that by and large, their education has happened when the instructor, the person in authority in the classroom has not been of color. This is largely the experience for our students. So that question about pedagogy, again, these are important, but if we sort of try to, you know, deconstruct almost the language that we use to talk about it and think about it again on the ground, if we are in the Freedom School, if we're thinking locally, in our local conditions, we are not actually actively engaging the thought, the knowledge, the experience, the bodies, right, of people of color as knowledge producers and not simply as objects of knowledge. So that absolutely has to be stated at the forefront. I think, again, when we also face up to the fact that the United States is a country that made literacy, right, a prohibition on the basis of race, that these aspects are so central to understanding student experience, especially the experiences of students of color. So we talk about underrepresented first generation, And I would argue that the language we need to be using is a history of racial exclusion and oppression, right? Not that someone was underrepresented or first gen, but that historically we've actively produced the conditions to ensure that these people were not permitted to engage in, again, what as a society we have said are the pathways to a good job, to civic inclusion, so on and so forth. So again, our language is really crucial here. And that, I think, feeds into that pedagogy question. From what perspective do we enter into the classroom to enable our students to work in a way that allows them, again, to grapple with these complex issues and also to face up to what's killing them? So I had this really phenomenal experience of meeting with an educator poet from New Orleans who was working at the center for students. Again, this is post-Katrina, where they're literally creating curriculum and a classroom experience for students. Again, post-Katrina, as people know, we've shut down all the schools. I mean, this is the reality. And I remember speaking to him. I had really been at UCSB just for a couple of years. And, you know, unfortunately, as professors do, you know, complaining about students, that was when I stopped doing it. But, you know, I was saying, here's what's happening in the classroom. They maybe don't seem so interested, or I can't elicit things from them. And he asked me, what do you want your students to do? And I was kind of meandering, like, well, you know, I think this or that. And he said, if you can't clearly articulate for yourself what it is you're after, why are you expecting your students to do something that you yourself are struggling to do? So that kind of clarity was very poignant for me. And it also helped me to remember, right, that we are in a society that's actively producing and legislating amnesia, right? Mm-hmm. Erasure and disappearance and violence and so on and so forth. So if those are the conditions that our students are entering the university with, then we might need a different kind of starting point to really begin to allow them, right, to engage with the materials that we are wanting both to teach, but also how we think about engaging with their minds. So there's a lot of processes, I think, involved in, again, you know, what people used to refer to broadly as sort of a decolonial education. I think we're a little more sophisticated in what we mean by that at this point. But again, those conditions that are shaping our worlds are so important to address in order to do that work, right, of teaching. And I think that thinking about that is good pedagogy.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And that's very helpful, like, for me as well. And I never really recognized the language, the passive versus active, like not just randomly underrepresented, but actively excluded.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I also know that beyond the classroom, you're active in reading groups and that you are active in an on-campus reading group on abolition. Can you tell us about that, like, experience of collectively reading about abolition?
Yeah, that's been really important, you know. So this really grew out of a UC-wide coalition, really Cops Off Campus, which is the organized or the grouping, is really national. But there was a specific UC-wide iteration, and we've been meeting pretty regularly for the past year or so. And the goal was to think about things that, again, can happen on individual UC campuses that were feeding into these both statewide and national kind of synergies and building energy really in opposition to policing with the goal of abolition. So that meant trying to figure out a way to just bring people together. Again, some of that is Freedom School model or what, you know, people have done all over, which is to come together and learn together. And I think that that is crucial that, you know, as so many people were watching the so-called George Floyd protests, again, we know it wasn't just about George Floyd, but again, it's come to be known as such. But as people were, again, continually responding to state violence, terror, we were also thinking about how to engage with these issues and keep pushing for the kinds of transformations with regard to state power and violence. And so trying to, again, make sense of our conditions meant that we needed to get educated, right? So how does one understand the relationship, say, between a UC campus and law enforcement? Why do UCs have a police force? And why do they command the millions of dollars that they command, especially given what, ask any undergraduate and they'll tell you, the cost of education, not to mention the cost of living and attending a UC's has, again, exponentially increased over the past 30 years, right? 40 maybe at this point. So how does anyone understand that, right? Why so much funding for policing? Why might it be more lucrative to become a UC police department officer than an assistant professor? How does that come to make sense? And what is it that the UCPD actually does, right? If you look across the country, you'll notice that a lot of the citations that UC officers, not just UC, but campus police are giving out have mostly to do with drinking and substance use. So are those issues that we might consider solving in a different way, right? That might also be more effective, less violent, and not in a tradition of, again, settler colonialism, anti-Black violence, militarism, and state violence. So a lot of what the reading group then was trying to make sense of was, how did we come to be, right, a campus that invests so heavily in policing students? And I think especially at a campus like UC Santa Barbara, that in these sort of national statistics and so on, has had a reputation as a so-called party school. And people think about Halloween or Deltopia or something like that. And then you start to sort of research and think about the expenditures for just those sort of, you know, annual or biannual events, how much is being paid for the policing of students. You start to talk to students about their experiences on an average weekend, you know, in the shadows of the university, how often they're being arrested and literally shaken down for money to pay fines. What does that money go to? Haven't people imagined other solutions that were more productive of producing a community spirit of safety and well-being, but that didn't involve the punitive state force of the police? Thinking about, you know, the property taxes, rent levels, what it costs to live, transportation, all of these factors start to help us to understand a little bit better the relationship between the campus and that history of policing. And even after that, we haven't yet talked about, right, protests, student protests against war, against tuition hikes, protests by custodial and janitorial workers, protests by graduate students arguing why they need a cost of living adjustment, by students who are making demands about inclusion, about the abysmal numbers of Black students, say, on a campus. So when we start to think about all of those factors and how and why the police come in to function as a source of repression for precisely those voices, for that energy and for that opposition, we start to build a much more robust understanding about how policing functions in even the very specific example of UC Santa Barbara. So that was the goal of the reading group, was to develop that kind of common understanding, which again is very difficult to do. I would encourage anyone listening to just try to get the budget, right, for policing, for pick any UC, but to get a clear sense of the budget that this is very, very difficult task. So that was the goal of the reading group.
Yeah, I think that's very important, especially everything you mentioned about the policing of students, the Deltopia, the abysmal number of Black students and students of color. That these were all things that really I was struck by when I first went to Santa Barbara.
It's a beautiful location. We certainly have our issues, but that's back to that local, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that the examples, right, that happen in Los Angeles or in the Bay or Rikers or New York or Chicago, that those are insignificant, but in our very specific local community, right, understanding those ties are often useful in being able to do the work of saying, we have a different proposal for how we might mm-hmm. live and exist in this world in a way that is actually producing the kind of harmony, the kind of happiness, the kind of possibilities that we all actually want.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So speaking of readings, are there like specific readings or pieces of writing or books that you find really inspiring or that have guided your work? What are some recommendations of must-read works for you?
You know, as a scholar and a professional, I'm an academic, so my profession is reading. You know, like many people, I'm sure, out there, I too sometimes am overwhelmed by how much there is to read and to know. And so I share that with a lot of people. But I am very excited about how much new literature is emerging. I just put a couple on the desk. There's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of great stuff. So I'm just mentioning a few, and it's no shade to books that I don't recall. But I do find this collection, We Do This Till We Free Us, to be really extraordinary. I think especially for people who are coming into this conversation, it's a really great text to start with, you know, short pieces that are very direct. It's not, you know, if people are interested in that, it's not, you know, sort of high academic jargon, even though what they're presenting is incredibly powerful and referring to deeply complex issues. But that one, I think, is really, really useful. I am in an English department, so I do study literature. In my class this quarter, on the section on policing, we will read Sing, Unburied Sing. This is a novel by Jessamyn Ward, which is absolutely extraordinary writing about, you know, issues related to poverty, anti-blackness, its long history, substance use, single parenthood, intimate harm and violence, and in the context of thinking about policing and incarceration as well. So sometimes those literary or even poetic interventions, I think, are quite powerful in getting people to understand that when we're talking about policing, we're not actually really talking about crime or bad people doing bad things. We are talking about questions of state power and how that power produces, right, conditions that people are trying to make sense of as they are in the process of living out their lives. And then the last one that I'll mention again, just for the sake of time, is this collection. It's called Pleasure Activism. You know, as many people saw on Twitter and Instagram and so on, you know, a lot of people have been making references to James Baldwin or Audre Lorde, as they should. These are incredible thinkers. But, you know, Audre Lorde, her piece on the uses of the erotic is republished here. But this question of pleasure and sensuality as central to the work that we do of transformation, self, you know, interpersonal, communal, and, you know, expanding outward, that our cause is just, it's righteous, it's beautiful, and that there is tremendous pleasure in the kinds of bonds that we form with others as we participate in the work of radical transformation, that this should be something that is exciting to people, that it's irresistible and clear, right, why we want to move forward in this way. So I think about those three in particular because they do remind us, again, of the pleasure of the hard work and the creative and imaginative work that we have before us.
Thank you so much for these recommendations. I'll definitely look into them. They sound so interesting. So finally, is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you would like to share with our listeners or takeaways that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, so the one thing that I would like to just put in everyone's ear I've recently accepted the position as senior editor for the incredible journal Kao Fu. This is a journal of comparative and relational ethnic studies. We have a call for papers out right now. The topic is in subordinate space, and we're also thinking about the work that we do given the de-radicalization of the university. So how do we think about education, you know, potentially from this freedom school model as we continue to do the work of engaging each other's minds and building towards this other future? So we're really excited for people to look at the call, to send in their work, and for us to, again, collectively gather and think how we can, again, change the world. So I would just love to bring attention to that and hope that people will check out the journal and consider submitting something.
Thank you so much, Professor. I learned so much from this conversation from you today. And yeah, I really appreciate the time and all of the knowledge that you shared with us.
Thanks again for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk.